Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Okay, please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Julie H., from the Walk the Walk group in Reading, Pennsylvania.
Hello, everybody. My name's Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. And it'll take me a minute before all your faces blend and, you know, me and God can unite, and I won't be nervous anymore. But as I said, my name's Julie, and I'm an alcoholic, and I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. I sponsor women, and I have a home group, which is Walk the Walk. It meets at Atonement Lutheran Parish Tuesdays and Thursdays at 5:45. And I say those things because those are important components for what has helped me learn how to live the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And living the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is what's given me a life. I landed in Pennsylvania, in Reading, Pennsylvania, about 10 years ago, a really destroyed and broken person that didn't really care to live. Tried to die, wasn't in the cards. So I began to get a little bit of hope that maybe if I tried this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous one more time in my life, that I might find the freedom that other people had found. I attended my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was about 22 years old. I got sober for a period of time when I was 25 years old in Southern California, where I grew up. God, it's really uncomfortable having this whole deal here. What do I do with my hands? I got sober for a period of time in Southern California, in the Los Angeles area where I grew up, and I stayed sober for about 6 years, and I worked the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, I kind of got a PhD in it. I studied it. You guys told me how to behave, and I behaved that way, but I didn't incorporate the program of Alcoholics Anonymous into my heart and into my soul. And when pain came, I did have a relationship with a power greater than myself, but I was about to marry him. So when pain came, I couldn't stay sober. and that's what happened. I'll start a little bit with telling you what it was like. My story began and ended with alcohol, and this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I will do the best I can to keep it to alcohol. There were a lot of drugs in the middle there because I knew what an alcoholic was from a very young age. It was my father, and I wasn't going to be that. So, and my husband's, and I wasn't going to be that. You know, like, I knew what an alcoholic was, and I had this motto in high school that says, I can use but not abuse, and that was my motto. And I got drunk very young at family gatherings, like 3-4 years old. I think I had my stomach pumped a couple of times before I was 10. I used to do things like crawl up into the medicine chest and get this bottle of green cough syrup. It was called Novahistine D, but it used to have codeine in it, and it tasted like crap, but I would drink the whole thing. I've been an alcoholic forever. I've been an alcoholic forever. I don't know, nature, nurture, it doesn't really make a difference to me. Every cell of my being has had an intimate relationship with alcoholism. It was the most intimate relationship I'd had for most of my life. And, it went on like that for me, and it progressed. You know, it progressed for me in the same ways it progressed for other people. The difference was that in my view, my illusion was I pointed my finger at everybody else. My illusion was that, you know, I married the Hell's Angel who drank a 12-pack to get out of bed in the morning. So that if I was, you know, doing some drugs or drinking a little bit every day, it didn't really make any difference because it was never going to compare to him. My illusion was I wasn't like my father. My illusion was I wasn't like my brothers. And so I spent a lot of time pointing my finger. I was a child who always had a hole in my soul. I thought that the problem with me was that I was ugly and I was stupid and I was fat, and that if I could just be beautiful. And see, when I was young, I didn't have blonde hair. Now that it's turned white, I can dye it blonde pretty easily. But when I was young, I had dark, dark, curly hair, and I was chubby. And I grew up in Southern California where the pretty girls were tall and thin with blue eyes, and long blonde straight hair on the beaches of Malibu. So, you know, that was my problem. My problem was that I wasn't attractive. And if I were attractive, I would be okay. You know, I can remember being a young child and thinking I only wish that somebody in this world would love me. And that doesn't mean that there weren't people in this world that loved me as a young child. That meant that I just couldn't incorporate it. I couldn't feel it. It was never enough. Even love wasn't enough. Nothing was ever enough. No alcohol was ever enough. No love was ever enough. No money was ever enough. No drugs were ever enough. No man was ever enough. For me, before I began really working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and living it, nothing was ever enough for me. I had, you know, I always wanted more. Whatever it was at that moment that I believed would fix me, I wanted a lot of it. And, you know, I did a lot of things trying to fill that hole in my soul. I had a lot of sex with a lot of men, and I did a lot of drugs and alcohol. And I even at 12, I joined, I'm first generation American. My family is from Palestine. They're Christian Arabs. And at 12 years old, I joined the Jewish temple because all my friends were Jewish. And so I believed that if I became Jewish, that's what was going to fix me. And so here I was, the token Arab girl at Proud Jewish Youth every Wednesday night. I mean, you know, like I knew early that there was something wrong with me. I just didn't think it was fixable. You know, I spent a long time thinking that I was too broken to ever be fixed. And, you know, I went through my adolescence, I don't know if it was much like other people. I went through my adolescence with these two older brothers that I had that were 5 and 6 years older than I was, and they were drug dealers. And at that time, I could point my finger at them, and I could say, you know what, I'm not like them. I'm smarter than them. I'm better than them. So they looked pretty bad. My brothers in the early and mid-1970s were going out into the Mojave Desert, and they were manufacturing PCP, and they were selling it to a lot of Los Angeles County, which made them very, very strange people. They were very, very weird people. It was not hard to look better than them. But and then I had this father that around the age of 10 broke his neck in a drunk driving accident, and he didn't get out of bed for 5 years. And my mother decided that her solution to that problem was to go back to college, and she went to UCLA, and she took 21 credits on the trimester system and became an honor student. So she was never home. So here I am, I'm in this house, you know, where, like, I believe that all the pretty good-looking people out there have it right and I have it wrong, and I'm in this house with this man who doesn't talk and doesn't get out of bed, doesn't go to work. The grass is getting taller around the house. The pool is getting greener. And, of course, since pretty things are what make you okay, that was my problem. If my father would get out of bed and the pool wasn't green and the grass wasn't tall, then I would be okay. And somehow or another in there around 12 years old, I ended up in the hospital with an onset of ulcers. And when I left the hospital after a two-week stay, they gave me a prescription for Valium. And I didn't particularly care for Valium, but what Valium did for me was it gave me my gateway into anything else I wanted because I knew people that cared for Valium. I knew adults that would buy me alcohol that cared for Valium, and I knew people who would trade pot for Valium. And that was the first time in my life where I felt a part of anything. I grew up across the street from a park. So, you know, me and my Valium prescription headed over to the park parking lot, and we began to do business and make friends. You know, that was my solution to feeling alone and lonely and having that hole in my soul was, you know, I had a commodity now. And so on Friday night, people wanted me around. In those days, Valium was not monitored. And I could, you know, because I had so much parental supervision, we had a charge at the drugstore, and it was an unending prescription, and I could go refill it whenever I wanted. How in the world those things happened, I don't know. But they made sense to me at the time. It was just a gold mine. My favorite thing to trade my Valium for was Akadama plum wine. It wasn't so bad when I threw it up. You know, it was still a little sweet when I was throwing it up on people's feet. So, you know, if that tells you at all what seemed intelligent to me at 12, 13 years old, you know, I went through most of my adolescence kind of like that. I got into high school, and like I said, I had these brothers that were drug dealers that were 5 and 6 years older than I was, and what that did for me there. I'd gotten kicked out of the Los Angeles public school system, and I got kicked out of the Los Angeles public school system for swearing. So that kind of dates you and tells you quite how old I am. But I got kicked out of the Los Angeles public school system, and I had these wealthy grandparents that lived in the South, and they paid for me to go to a private school. And again, I was put in a situation where everybody looked pretty. They had pretty cars, and they had pretty clothes, and their parents were not laying in bed with the grass getting taller and the pool getting greener, you know, and things like that. But my commodity there were, you know, my brothers could get drugs that I could sell to these kids at school, and then they wanted me on a Friday night. You know, I remember that I used to have a pint of vodka stashed under the bathroom sink in high school. And to me, that was just perfectly normal. There was nothing wrong with that. Never occurred to me that that was a problem. That was just fun. And, you know, that's sort of how things went for me. You know, I always found a way to have a commodity to feel like I could be a part of, whether or not it was alcohol, whether or not it was drugs, whether or not it was my feminine wiles, or whether or not, you know, it was something else. I always found a commodity that made me feel like I was a part of. So I never had an intimate human connection with people. It was a barter system. You know, I'll give you this, and then I'll own you. You know, I take hostages. So somewhere around my late adolescence, I met the Hells Angel. And I didn't like him very much, and I couldn't stand to be around him. And he said, "Let's get married," and I said, "Okay." That made sense to me at the time. I was not pregnant. What the truth is if I tell you the really sad truth, the truth is I never thought anybody else would ask. And what I thought was I would have a husband, and we would have a house. And I would keep it clean, and I would make it pretty, and I would have a family, and then I would be okay. And that would be the solution to the hole in my soul. And so I married this biker guy, and, you know, the poor guy. I set potential for him that he was never going to live up to. And if he got anywhere close to it, I raised the bar even higher. You know, I cut his hair. I fixed his teeth. I took him out of the biker jacket and gave him a members only jacket. Can you imagine? I mean, it was really, I look back on it now and I can laugh, but that poor guy just didn't have a shot in hell. He was 10 years older than I am, and, you know, the first thing his mother said to me was, "You're too good for him." And I thought, oh, this poor guy, he needs me. His mother doesn't even love him right, but I'll love him right, you know. I'm sure that at least one of you out there can relate to this. So, you know, I married the biker, and it didn't fix the hole in my soul because he was an alcoholic and he made my life miserable. During that time was when I began to become strung out on heroin, but he was an alcoholic, and that made my life miserable. I didn't drink when I was married to my husband because I wanted to show my husband that you could live without alcohol. It did not occur to me that, you know, I was substituting for something else. And so eventually we got evicted from one place too many because, you know, Hell's Angels have a tendency of beating each other with 4x4s. And not going to work. And so we got evicted from one place too many, and I ran home to my parents. I have to tell you, like, my mother's side of the family are nice Southern politicians and things like that. You know, they dress for dinner. The Hell's Angel deal didn't go over very well. My grandfather cried in the front row of that wedding. You know, in the designer wedding dress, I have to tell you, like the handmade lace wedding gown, because I had to look good because that's what was going to make me okay. I'm walking down the aisle, you know, and there's guys in the background. Yeah, we're getting married in the Christian Orthodox Church. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it. It's much like Catholicism. It takes a long time. It's very ritualistic, and it's very conservative. You know, my idea of what made sense was just really off the charts. So I left this guy. I had a child by the time I left him. She was about a year old, and he was my problem, and so I left him. And I was in my early 20s, maybe 22 or so, and I went off to get a pretty apartment and a pretty job and start my life. And yet again, I redecorated the street. That's what I've grown to call it, is that I am excellent at redecorating the same street over and over again. But to actually really walk on a different street, I need God. Left to my own devices, I just keep redecorating. So anyway, I left him because he was my problem, and lo and behold, that monkey on my back, it didn't end. And so I was on my own. See, when I had the Hell's Angel to go get all the things for me I needed to get, I really wasn't putting myself in risky situations. That was what, you know, one of the things he was good for. But, you know, now I was on my own, and I was a single mother. And for a while I tried to be employable as a cocktail waitress. And because a cocktail waitress can spend the days with her daughter, right? Not if she's sleeping until she goes to work. So anyway, you know, I came to a point in my early 20s where I began to believe that I was a drug addict. I never believed I was an alcoholic, but I began to believe that I might be a drug addict and that cocaine was a problem for me. So I went to this outpatient drug and alcohol treatment program at UCLA, and they co-signed it. They said, we think you probably shouldn't drink, but you definitely shouldn't do cocaine. And so probably shouldn't drink to me meant, you know, like I should try and control it, right? So that was my first experience with any kind of 12-step. They sent me to Narcotics Anonymous, and I went to, in Los Angeles, and I went to Narcotics Anonymous meetings for a while. And I went there, and I said, I met people that I'd known from the streets, and I said, you know, what are you doing here? And they said, we just don't use one day at a time, do the next right thing, and we don't get high. And I thought, well, that doesn't make any sense. And so, you know, I tried doing that whole deal, the Narcotics Anonymous deal, but, you know, 24 hours without a drink pill or a fix for me at that time was just not an option. And so I was trying to do the I'm clean thing and still use thing, which leads to very suicidal behavior for me, you know. So eventually, one thing came to another. I had this, at this point, I went from the Hell's Angel to a nice Christian boy who absolutely did not approve of my lifestyle. And so, you know, at this point, I was trying to do what I did in, you know, behind the scenes. And I was lying to everybody. And I couldn't work. And I couldn't go to school. And I couldn't get out of bed. And I didn't want to live. And I knew that I had tried for 25 years to be fixed, and I was still broken. And so I had a pretty serious suicide attempt. And, you know, God intervened, long story short. But, you know, somebody called me while I was passed out in my bed. I put my daughter to bed at like 10 o'clock in the morning. She was a couple of years old at the time. And I took this big barrel bottle full of pills, and my phone rang, and I answered it. And it was some girl who lived in another state who'd never met my family that I had met in my travels. And she said, what's going on? And, you know, by this point, I'm completely mind-altered. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to die. I can't live. And, you know, this girl knew very little about who I was. But what she did was I hung up the phone, and she called. She remembered that when she met me, I was living in my parents' home. And my last name was not the same as my parents' last name because I'd been married. But I was living in my parents' home. And above the garage, there was a placard with their last name on it. And she remembered that. And she was in another state. But she called information, and she asked for anybody with my parents' last name. And lo and behold, my mother answered the phone. And she sent my mother to, I get goosebumps. She sent my mother to my house. And my mother came in, and God, I was awful. You know, I was really awful. She called 911, and they said, you know, we can't do anything unless she accepts treatment. And I, you know, was blubbering about how I wasn't going to accept treatment because I really wanted to die. And she, my mother's on her hands and knees begging me to do something to help myself. And, you know, of course, the self-centered, selfish human being that I was, it was like, but you don't understand my pain. See my pain. And, you know, eventually what happened was I ended up in a county psychiatric facility as a result of that attempted suicide. And at the end of about 24 hours, they came to me and they said, we think that you're an alcoholic and a drug addict. And we're going to put you on a 21-day hold unless you'll go to a rehab. And I, honest to God, did not think that I was an alcoholic and a drug addict. What I thought, and what I thought for a long time in my life, was that if I started drinking or using, there would be consequences. But I didn't care. Consequences never stopped me from utilizing my active addiction ever. So that's what I thought. An alcoholic and a drug, my brothers were drug addicts. You know, my brother, by the age of 39, exploded from the abdomen with cirrhosis of the liver and died. My other brother, at the age of 39, 15 months later, had a brain aneurysm smoking crack and died. My father died of a grand mal seizure. Those guys were the heavyweights. I knew what a heavyweight looked like. And at 25, I still really wasn't in their league. I clearly, looking back, was an alcoholic and an addict. But I wasn't in their league, and I was so busy pointing fingers. But anyway, the idea of three hots and a cot for a month without having to take care of my kid, the screaming kid, and, you know, finding money and all that kind of stuff, everybody off my back, that sounded okay. So I went to this drug and alcohol treatment program, and it was at a place called St. Joseph's Hospital in Burbank, California. And in those days, drug and alcohol treatment programs were still housed within medical facilities, and you could still smoke in hospitals. So, you know, as long as I could smoke, I was fine. The thing they didn't tell me was that I couldn't smoke unless I went to groups. I couldn't smoke unless I got my clothes back. I couldn't get my clothes back as long as I was on detox meds. And I couldn't go to groups unless I was off detox meds. So basically, they held me hostage with my cigarettes to give up my drugs. And something happened while I was there. And I was young, and in Southern California, the blessing of Southern California is there are a lot of really young, happy people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we had people come in from AA, hospitals and institutions, and they would say things like, try it for 30 days. We'll refund your misery. Don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle. Doing what you got, your best thinking got you here. You know, they said all the slogans that we hear over and over again that I had heard for the very first time. My very first AA speaker meeting while I was in that hospital, they passed the basket around the meeting, and there was this guy who must have gotten the same message that I got, that they wanted business attire for the speaker, and he was wearing a suit and a tie, and he was standing up there telling his story, and I looked in that basket, and I thought, man, these people are willing to work for pittance. You know, I could not figure out how you were going to get those dollars to stretch to pay him. You know, it was was as much as I knew. Even after I had attended meetings of Narcotics Anonymous, that was still how much I knew about AA. But something happened to me in there, and I began to get a little hope. And I stayed in that program for 6 weeks. The last 2 weeks I was there, they asked me to get a sponsor and use it like a halfway house. At that time, there wasn't a halfway house where I could go and take my daughter. So they asked me to use it like a halfway house. And if I wanted to stay there, I had to get somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous to come pick me up and take me to 3 meetings a day for the 2 weeks I was there. And that was absolutely amazing, because what it did was it got me hooked in with some people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did that. And when I got out of that treatment program, I hit Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, as hard as anybody has hit Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm a people pleaser, and I was going to do it perfect. And I did it pretty well for a long time. You know, I went to a lot of meetings. I sponsored women. I had a sponsor. My sponsor had a sponsor. I had a home group. I did service work. I did all those things. I was a member of a group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Southern California called the Pacific Group, and it's Clancy's group. I don't know if any of you have ever heard any speaker tapes by Clancy, but it's a big, huge group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's very, very active in service. And they taught me some amazing habits of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was in that group. And for a while, you know, I stayed away from men, sort of. But, you know, enough to stay sober. And then I was at this AA dance, and there was this guy that, you know, had been looking at me across the room for a while that I thought was kind of nice. And you know, Madonna came on the radio singing on the jukebox or whatever it was, singing Crazy for You, and there was this disco ball spinning. And, you know, I was wearing, like, my little mini skirt with my red cowboy boots and looking really fine, and he was wearing his bolo tie and looking really fine. We were talking mid-'80s. And, you know, basically boy met girl on AA campus. You know, we met in the middle of the disco ball and never separated from there on out. And you know, when I was 28 years old in Alcoholics Anonymous, there were a lot of things, you know, I was very arrogant still. And I had not really found much humility. What I had found were a lot of good habits that kept me sober for a while. you know, I even well into the relationship was still practicing those good habits because I was an ACE member of Alcoholics. I was a poster child, for God's sakes. And, you know, so I was still going to the meetings and I was still doing my service work and I was doing, they have something there called hospitals and institutions. If you want to go into an institution, it's separate from intergroup or separate from general services. You have to be a member of hospitals and institutions. And I was taking meetings once a month into prisons and, you know, the whole bit. And, but eventually what happened was that we got married and the doo-doo hit the fan. The Bandini is an old form of manure. It was a brand of manure when I was a kid. The Bandini hit the fan, and it went flying all over the place, and I got some excruciating pain. I had a child in that marriage, and she was a couple of months old, and I had the perfect life. I had the perfect outsides. I had a big diamond ring, a couple of carrots, two luxury cars in the driveway, a big house, a handsome husband, 1.5 kids that was earning a great living. I had a live-in nanny. You know, all the things that were going to make my outsides great. I had all of the trimmings. You know, I had my Platinum American Express card, and it was paid off monthly. And he came home, and he told me he was having an affair. And I didn't have a power greater than myself other than him to help me through that pain. And I had 1.5 children, shame in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because, you know, God, what would everybody think? I don't think they thought what I thought they thought, but that's what I thought was what would everybody think if I was no longer the poster child of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for a while, even after that, he moved out, and I went to meetings, and I raised my hand, and I said, I'm in a lot of pain, and I want to drink. And they said, just don't drink, and you won't get drunk. And I said, but I want to drink. You don't get it. I want to drink. And they said, just don't drink and you won't get drunk. And I called my sponsor and I called everybody I knew every day and I continued to do the service work. But I didn't put my recovery first in my heart and in my soul. And I didn't really want to let go of the relationship. We didn't talk for a while and we didn't live together for a while. But there was a time and place where I thought we were going to reunite. And and as it turned out, he probably, you know, has an additional addiction that he was practicing at that time in his life. And so there were a number of, you know, women pregnant, lots of other things going on that I didn't know about. And when I found out about that stuff, the pain was so amazingly great that I was at his place of business and I walked across the street to 7-Eleven, and I, 7-Eleven in Southern California sells beer and wine. Grocery stores sell hard liquor. But I walked across the street to 7-Eleven, and I bought a Colt 45, and I drank it. But before I did that, I had thrown a self-centered, self-seeking alcoholic temper tantrum, and I had driven my Volvo across this major boulevard of Southern California called Van Nuys Boulevard. I don't know if any of you seen American Graffiti. That's where they cruised up and down Van Nuys Boulevard. But anyway, I drove it across into traffic, and I got out of my car, and I walked into 7-Eleven, and I had hit like three cars. And I cracked open a beer. It was 110 degrees, and I sat down on the curb, and I started to drink it, and the next thing I know, I had handcuffs on. Now, let me tell you, through the Hell's Angel and the heroin addiction and all that stuff, I'd never had handcuffs on. But with 6-plus years of sobriety, 2 sips of beer, I had handcuffs on. That should have told me something, but it didn't. The women I sponsored and my sponsor came over to my house that day and took the distributor cap off my car. They told me that, you know, they'd watch my kids while I drank if I was willing to go into rehab once I threw up, and I said, fine. Took me 48 hours to throw up, and I went into rehab. But I was never fully surrendered. I was truly never fully surrendered. I don't know where he went for that period of time, but I went into rehab, and I came out, and I started working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous again. But here was the deal, was that I had 6-plus years of sobriety when I picked up that Colt 45. So I had 6-plus years of progression of the disease of alcoholism. And so when I picked up that Colt 45, the sobriety that had kept me sober for those 6 years was no longer going to keep me sober at that time. It had to be a different program, but I didn't get it. I'd been the poster child for Alcoholics Anonymous, so I thought, I'm going to go do what I did. I'll go to a lot of meetings. I'll do a lot of service work. I'll stay away from men, sort of. And, you know, I'll do what I did. And I did it for a little while. And then one day in the mail, because we didn't have email or text messaging or anything like that then, was a letter from him. This is so freaking classic. I have a friend of mine in the Reading area that calls my life a bad ABC after school special, and really it couldn't be on ABC, but it is a bad after school special. I get this letter in the mail, and he says, whatever you do, don't divorce me, because I've joined the Navy and my checks are going to be directly deposited into our bank account. So my husband, that went from making a high six-figure income, joined the Navy drunk as a seaman apprentice to making $800 a month, and I loved him. You know, I loved him. I tortured him the whole time he was in boot camp. Can I just tell you that this man also, I've come to learn, had a potential that I set for him that he was never going to live up to? That was what I did to men before Alcoholics Anonymous. I set a potential. There was nothing called unconditional love. I saw what you could be if you were only living up to your potential. And as soon as you got close to what I saw you could be, I raised the bar. So during the time he was in boot camp, you know, I would Federal Express him Dear John letters and, you know, all these things that I thought were, you know, cute and adorable and trying to get out my anger. And eventually what happened was the commander of the base he was on put us in phone marriage counseling while he was in boot camp. And so every day he had to come, because they got sick of me calling him. So every day he had to come and he had to call me with his CO sitting there. And a psychologist, and we had to do a phone therapy session. And what happened at the end of that was that I consented to go with him in the military. I said, you know, it's not going to be permanent. I'm going to leave my things in California. I'll just move with you for a while, and we'll see how it works. But, you know, he was my drug of choice at that point. I may have been dry, but he was my drug of choice at that point. He was my drug of choice, my higher power. The thought of living without him, you know, gave me that nauseous withdrawal feeling like, you know, anything else that I had, you know, any other chemical that I thought about living without. So I left the state, and I left any kind of sober support group that I had. So any chance I had of staying sober was really shot. What happened was I moved, and I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we were initially in Florida. And I ended up with a migraine after, I don't know, I was maybe 10 or 11 months sober, something like that, 9, I don't know. I ended up with a migraine for a number of days. And my sponsor in Florida said, we must take you to the emergency room. And I said, okay, that sounds like a great idea. And they said, the only thing we have to offer you is Demerol. And I said, okay, that sounds like a great idea. And I can't tell you when that 50-milligram shot of Demerol turned into, making every pill I could find water-soluble and drinking every ounce of alcohol I could find 10 years later. But I could not get sober again. I could not. My higher power taught me the true meaning of powerlessness. It means for me that without you, first of all, without you, I will pick up a drink, pill or a fix. I will talk myself into it because I live with illusion. I have great illusions in my mind, things that I believe are real that are actually false, but I can rationalize my way into any illusion. And without you, I will drink, and that if I drink, I cannot predict the outcome. Not I'll have consequences, because like I said, consequences won't keep me sober. They won't. I don't care. Not even I'll die, because dying would have been preferable to getting sober again as far as I was concerned. But I might live, and I cannot predict the outcome. And substances don't work for me anymore. By the time I got sober again, that 10 years we moved all over the country, and, you know, he practiced his addictions and I practiced my addictions, and never the twain shall meet. We didn't even like each other much to practice anything together. Actually, we lived in a townhouse for the last couple of years, and he lived in the basement and I lived on the top floor and the kids lived in the middle. And that wasn't a finished basement. It was a twin mattress on a concrete floor. But we were a happy couple. The world thought we were a happy couple. The marriage got violent at some point, which, you know, only fueled my addiction more, because when somebody is breaking your bones, you get drugs. And so I was not particularly upset about that. I thought I was. I was dramatic about it. Let's just say that. Very dramatic about it. I was a huge victim about it. But I wasn't really, truly, particularly upset about it. What ended up happening towards the end was that as a result of an incident, I ended up with a plate in my neck, and then I tried to kill myself. And it was another pretty serious suicide attempt. I drank everything that we had in the house. I took every pill I had in the house, and I went outside and passed out in the snow. And, you know, in a very dramatic alcoholic way, you know. I do everything in a very dramatic alcoholic way. It couldn't just be, you know, like I went to a gas station bathroom and died quietly on my own or anything. Everybody had to walk over my body. And so it's so nice to know that about myself and be okay with it today. So he found me. You know, when he came home from wherever he was doing his thing that night, he stepped over my body and he thought, oh, she's pretty passed out. And he picked me up and he put me in bed. And 4 days later, I came to. And somehow, I don't really know what happened, but my head was split open and I didn't have anything to stop the shakes or the sickness in my house. Nothing. And at that point, I weighed 90 pounds. I had about 3 hairs in my head. I was in renal failure. I weighed 90 pounds and my ankles were bigger than my thighs. I had a couple of teeth in my mouth. I was malnourished. I was really physically ill besides chemically dependent to anything you put in front of my face. And so I didn't do everything ever unless I didn't plan on waking up. But I woke up 4 days later and I went to my higher power and I said, why didn't you take me to the hospital? And he said, because they would have figured out that you are a drug addict. And I said, well, but what are we going to, I went to my higher power, what are we going to do? I don't have anything. That's your problem. But, you know, he still took me to get more. That was our trade-off. I let him do what he wanted to do, and he took me to get more of anything, whenever I wanted it. And that was how it worked. But I began, the thing that happened to me with that, there were three things. There was the neck incident, there was that incident, and then there was one other incident I'll tell you about in the middle in a minute. But the thing that happened to me there, both my brothers and my father by this point had died. They died during my relapse, and that really fueled the relapse. They thought I was sober when they died. And I say this because I wasn't a nice, sober person to people in active addiction. They thought I didn't love them. And I loved them very much. I was angry at their disease. I loved them very, very much, but they didn't know that because I was not a graceful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a judgmental member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My brother, I told you, he exploded from the abdomen. He was in a room with my father that was probably not as big as this underhang, and they had been drinking together. My dad was a wet brain. My brother was physically very ill. He was dead for 4 days when my father finally ran out of vodka. They bought a case of gallons, and my dad finally ran out of vodka, and he went to my brother to get some more when he figured out that my brother's body was decomposed. He hadn't smelled the decay. You know, that's the kind of alcoholism that I come from, and that's the kind of alcoholic I am. And I pointed my finger at that kind of alcoholism for a long time and said, but I'm not like you. But by the time I was 41 years old and I'd had my neck smashed and I couldn't die, and, you know, there was an incident with my... I had gotten to the point where I was asked... I was leaving my car at the bar and waking my 18-year-old daughter up an hour before she had to be at high school so she could take me to get my car on her way to school. You know, my 6-year-old was coming home from school and asking me to help her with her homework, and I would have her pass it underneath the bathroom door because I couldn't get out of the bathroom. I was catching everything on fire. There was a huge fire towards the end. That was one of the things. There was a huge fire towards the end, and, you know, I made up some amazingly brilliant alcoholic story that I expected everybody to believe. And, you know, my 18-year-old daughter looked at me with those eyes, and I saw them, those eyes that we all see in the people who love us. You know, those eyes like, really? Really? I need you, and you're vacant, and you think I'm stupid, and you tell me you love me. And so those couple of things happened, and so, you know, eventually I called a girlfriend of mine that I had been an addictions counselor. When I told you, I got an A in AA. I went to addictions counseling school at UCLA, graduated, worked in treatment, the whole nine yards. So, you know, I was going to save the world. And I called someone that I used to work with in treatment in Southern California. At this point, I was in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. I'd lived in, like, seven different states in those 10 years. But at this point, I was in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania, and I called my friend Elaine, and I said, Lainey, I got a summer at the Betty Ford Center. I can't handle this anymore. And she said, there's a really good place for you in Pennsylvania with a relapse unit, and that's where I think you should go. And I said, what the hell could they possibly have in Pennsylvania? And she said, it's like a resort in the Poconos. So I spent a month shopping. She would not call. She gave me the number. She wouldn't help me get in. She just gave me the number. And I spent a month shopping with my personal shopper at Nordstrom's over the telephone. I had no money anymore. I mean, I had had money at one point, but at this point I had no money. But the illusion was, you know, thrilling. I bought matching ensembles to go to treatment. I showed up with, like, four suitcases, the bag that matched the purse, because, like I said, my mom's side of the family comes from the South, so your bag always has to match your shoes. And I showed up there, you know, like I said, 90 pounds with about four hairs, and my teeth rotten out of my head, and my ankles bigger than my thighs. My daughter asked me once if she could eat cereal out of the hole in my stomach because she said it looked like a cereal bowl. And I thought I looked hot. I was shopping in the children's section, and I thought I looked fine. Took me about an hour to paint the... Oh, and I dislocated my shoulder in a black hour right before I left to go. So in order to paint my makeup on, I was having to prop my elbow up on the wall and be like this. So anyway, I don't know what happened in that treatment facility, and I don't know why it happened there. All I know is that I went there believing that I would never come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought that there had to be something else that would help me live. I sort of thought maybe that, because I was in chronic pain, don't you know? I still have chronic pain, by the way. All the things that I was taking all those pills for, I still have, and it doesn't hurt nearly the way it used to. But I went there, you know, believing that they would find a different way for me. And something happened in one of the groups while I was still there. And somebody said to me, a man said to me, enough with this 24-hour bullshit. If you had to choose your drug of choice over your children for the rest of your life, what would you do? And at that very moment, God spoke to me. And I knew that that was an impossible choice. I would not choose my children. I knew that left to my own devices, I would tell my kids I loved them like I had for years. And I would dumpster dive for whatever it was I told them I wasn't going to go after. You know, that I was completely powerless over alcohol. And my life had become completely unmanageable. And for some reason, I began to understand that, see, I always thought, too, that the first step, our lives had become unmanageable, meant that once I sobered up, it wasn't that way anymore. I didn't understand that and don't ask me why, because I used to be able to recite the big book. I can't memorize a line in it anymore. That's another gift God's given to me. But, you know, I did not understand that we are like men who have lost their legs. We will never grow new ones. We'll grow new ones when we stop drinking. We will never grow new ones. The idea that we are like other people has to be smashed. I wanted to get sober and be like other people. I wanted to get sober and fix up the outsides and be like other people. And for some reason or another, I got that. I don't know why. I went to a halfway house. I stayed in treatment for 8 months. When it came time for me to get out, really I had nowhere to go. When they dropped me off, the tires burned rubber. Nobody came in to see if I was safe. They didn't care. So I went to a halfway house, and somebody suggested I move to Berks County, Pennsylvania. This is how I felt, that I honor Berks County, Pennsylvania with my presence. Because don't you know, I'm from Los Angeles. And that was like literally how I was still going to meetings. But for some reason, you know, I came to believe through putting my butt in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Now, the deal was, the other thing I came to understand, that what I used to think that was a white picket fence. I used to think sanity was a white picket fence, and happiness and ecstasy. And what I've come to find out sanity is it's not picking up a drink pill or a fix under all circumstances, no matter how scared I am, and no matter how much I hurt, or no matter, you know, how much I think that there's not a beginning, a middle, or an end to the consequences or the problems I've created in my life. That's what sanity is to me today. And when I became to trust that, it became much easier for me to turn my will and my life over to a power greater than myself. For me, my will and my life are my actions and my intentions. Because what I came to learn through reflection was that my actions could look good, but my intentions sucked. So for me, my will and my life are my actions and my intentions. And as long as I'm on, sometimes, you know, because I really believe that that I have to act my way into right thinking, not think my way into right acting. So sometimes I do have to act as if, but I have to be honest with my support group about my intentions. The women in my life have saved my life. They've taught me how to be a woman. They've taught me how to be a mother. They've taught me how to be an employee. They've taught me how to be a friend. They've taught me how to not set potential for anybody that they can't live up to. And, you know, that inventory process for me, it was filled with resentment. Like, there were pages. But, you know, like, partway through, I came to realize that it was all just my self-centered fear and abandonment and what about me. And that it didn't matter because I had come to a point where no matter what I resented anybody for, I had done worse in my act of addiction. And so if I wanted forgiveness, I had to realize that that father that I despised 13 years in the ground was never going to tell me he was sorry. You know, he wasn't going to pop up and say, Julie, I did you wrong. He had as many things go on in his life, and he had the disease of alcoholism. And I always expected other people's alcoholism to have integrity, but that wasn't the bar. That wasn't the potential I set for my alcoholism. Your alcoholism was supposed to respect me. It wasn't supposed to lie to me. It was supposed to understand, you know, my needs. But my alcoholism wasn't supposed to do that. And that was the greatest gift I got from the fourth step the first time around. The cool deal with the sixth and seventh step, I don't have to do it. I just have to be willing. The sixth step was the thing when I came back into Alcoholics Anonymous that scared me the most. Entirely ready, those were like commitment words. These steps have bizarre words in them. Decision, entirely, you know, these words that, you know, that imply that I can follow through with something. And see, I'm a great starter, but without God, I don't finish anything. And one day at a time, and it really is one day at a time for me, at the end of this month, I'll be 10 years sober. And I didn't expect that. And I don't live like I'm 10 years sober, and I'm grateful for that. I don't live like I'm 30 days sober, and I'm grateful for that, too. But I don't live like I'm 10 years sober. I learn every day. I still feel like very much of a newcomer. You know, and I still do the things I did when I was a newcomer. I still have good habits in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is truly feet first. My recovery is in my feet. It is not in my head. My head is still to this day left to its own devices, pretty messed up. But, you know, the other thing that the sixth and seventh step taught me was to tell the truth. Didn't ever occur to me. Never, ever occurred to me how easy the truth was. When I tell you how screwed up I am, that's the truth. I don't have to pretend like I'm not. When I tell you I'm afraid, that's the truth. I don't have to pretend like I'm not. I can tell the truth. I had to have surgery a couple of years ago. I was petrified. Petrified. I laid in that bed. It was a major surgery with a morphine drip, and all my friends in recovery came to see me. And there I am, high, thinking, I don't want them to know I'm high, because what if they take away the morphine? And finally, my best friend looks at me and she says, Julie, we know you're wasted. Just stop. And it was like, oh, my God, I'm on morphine. Of course I'm wasted. People get wasted on morphine. I need to tell these people the truth if I want to ever stop being on morphine, because it's a scary thing for me. It's a 50-50 shot. If you put any mind-altering substance in my body, that I'll put it down. And I believe that. If I had not had major body parts removed, I would not have used morphine. But the women in Alcoholics Anonymous got me through that. They came to me and they stood at the foot of my bed and they said, hand it over. You have to ask us for that. It doesn't matter if you take less than prescribed. You're still using a mind. Oh, do you know that when people get pain pills, it's not like antibiotics. They don't have to finish the prescription or get sick again. My sponsor told me that. I was amazed to hear that. So, you know, like the sixth and seventh step gave me the truth. The eighth and the ninth step gave me some dignity. You know, I walked around with like this unfinished crap, this whole filing cabinet of unfinished crap. There's still one amends, I got to tell you, I have not made. I'm honest about it. It's not even a huge amends. It's to my Aunt Julie. We call her the sergeant. She just still scares the crap out of me. She scared the crap out of me my whole entire life. And she's loving, and she loves me. And I just keep not doing it. And that's the only one I haven't done. And, of course, whenever I hear ninth step, my conscience pops up and says, you still got that one to do. So, you know, it will get done. The tenth step for me, the tenth step is an all-day deal. You know, if I don't know exactly how to make the amends that I need to make, then, you know, I got to take it to my support group and talk to somebody about it. I don't, you know, make amends if I think I'm going to get in trouble. But, you know, when I've bitten my daughter's head off, and it's how I said it and not what I said, I got to say I'm sorry. You know, I got to say I'm sorry right away. Otherwise, my active alcoholic children will not see that Alcoholics Anonymous produces women of dignity. I just want, my time is up, and I don't usually talk this long, so that's surprising to me. But, you know, for me, the 11th step was always really difficult. And then I read somewhere that when you read spiritual literature, that is seeking. And so that is meditation. And so early on in my recovery, that was the best I could do, was I could read spiritual literature. I could go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I could listen to you. And that was how I meditated. That was how I heard my higher power. And last but not least, I do carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous at any given opportunity, because when I came back into these rooms, Alcoholics Anonymous was here. And I didn't deserve for it to be. I've been given enormous grace. And so, you know, I feel like not an obligation. I want to give that back. But practicing these principles in all my affairs, these steps have given me a set of principles. And I didn't have any principles before I came here. I had whatever the principles were of the situation and the day. And now I have a consistent set of principles one day at a time that I can live by. Thank you so much for having me at your meeting and letting me share.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.